thanks for coming, because it is actually terrible out there, isn't it? So actually, it's quite nice in here, but terrible out there. So I'm going to talk to you about safe and effective drugs. And thanks for coming forward so I can see your face and you don't fall asleep. And if you do, I might ask you a question, so be careful. But I'm going to take you on a bit of a journey. And this journey starts for myself about 2089. But it starts about 40 years ago. So this is Archie Cochrane, 1979, who's telling us that what we need is a critical overview of all of the evidence, and it should be periodically adapted, and it's all the relevant randomized controlled trials. So if you really want to know about medicine, we need to have all the RCTs, and we need to get them all together on certain topics and understand them. And generally, that led to this important document. This is Effective Care in Pregnancy and Childbirth, which is Ian Chalmers there with other chaps, people. He brought together in pregnancy and childbirth what was the forebearers of the Cochrane Library, if you like. And this was an attempt to bring together all that evidence and systematically review it and put it into one volume. So this is 1990, the state of the art, and you see here, real milestone in the history of RCTs and the evaluation of care. And that led to the Cochrane Library thinking, because that's what Ian went on 3 years later to set out an editorial that said, here's the Cochrane Library. But at the same time, what this was starting to show was work that was happening in a number of publications. Here's Kay Dickerson in Controlled Clinical Trials, and here's Ian himself with some other people in JAMA in 1990, and that's about the same time, with a worrying concern that although there was all this randomized controlled trial evidence, there was a particular issue happening called publication bias, that it seemed that some of the trial data was never published. And this was the start of the issues that arose at that time. So that's 1990. Very quickly, we've gone from overview of the evidence into a problem where publication bias. Fast forward in 20 years later, in 2013, I became involved in an organization setting up the Old Trials Group, which basically said we would like all trials registered and reported in full. A very simple ask, if you like. And it's been signed by 94,730 people. Some people in this room haven't signed, and 748 organizations. But one of the fundamental principles that led to my involvement in Old Trials and why we got Old Trials was a particular research I got involved in on a drug called Tamiflu. And Tamiflu was a drug that was used in influenza outbreaks, and it had lots of claims. Now, I'm just going to take you back a little bit into the history of thinking about Tamiflu. The first thing is it was evaluated about 2000, and about 2005, Tamiflu use was minimal, hardly used, and in fact, the company Roche was thinking of giving the license back to Genentech. But in 2006, Donald Rumsfeld, remember the man of the known unknowns, was part of a report in the UN that said, we're going to look into how many predictive deaths would be caused by bird flu. You remember all that hysteria about bird flu? So let me ask you a question. How many predictive deaths would bird flu cause, do you think, worldwide and in the UK? Anyone? Very little. Given at that point in time, there'd been about 40 to 50 in the world, you're going to go, very little. Any movers on very little? In fact, the number is 150 million. And in the UK, it's 700,000 were predicted. And at that point, we started stockpiling antivirals because people said, we need to understand, we need to have something that helps us out. And in 2009, at the same time, we published this review with Matthew Shunshin. But the report from the UN had come out saying predicts 150 million deaths, okay? And that's when we started to produce 14.6 million courses of the drug. We'll avert some of the 700,000 deaths that might be expected. That's a lot of deaths, isn't it? It's about one in every 100 people. So it's about one of you in this room should be dead, basically. That's a lot of people. And you think about where we are in informing healthcare. Okay. Now, interestingly, the thought of sense, and now in 2009, we'd gone to the point where we'd moved on from swine flu, from bird flu to swine flu, haven't we? So we'd survived the bird flu, and now we're into the swine flu problem. And again, we've got apocalyptic warnings from officials. This is Liam Donaldson, who was the chief medical officer at the time, and he said it's 50,000 would be killed in the UK. Again, these positions. And in the World Health Organization, this is Margaret Chan saying, we have evidence to suggest we are in the first pandemic of the 21st century. And if you remember again in 2009, there were lots of echoes of the 2005 that this is a serious crisis, this is an epidemic, it's a pandemic. And therefore, in this country, what we had was we had situations where you'd phoned up a telephone line, and if you had a fever, you would be given automatically Tamiflu with no doctor's appointment. A very interesting, and we did the systematic review in children, and at the same time, there was also an adult review published. And this is a timeline of history of the reviews of Cochrane reviews and systematic reviews on oseltamivir. And here's the children one, which I'm part of, and this is a chap called Tom Jefferson, who was also doing the adult review. And one of the things was, this led to a new collaboration where we worked together to try and get all the evidence on the data from children and adults. This is an evolving story in my mind at the time, and all of our thinking at the time, but what happened in 2003, if this paper had been published in Archives Internal Medicine, and it wasn't quite a systematic review, but what it said is we analysed prospectively collected data on lower respiratory tract infections and antibiotic use from 3,500 patients enrolled in 10 placebo-controlled double-blinded trials of oseltamivir. So that was the largest data set at the time. This review included 10 randomised controlled trials. And then 10 randomized controlled trials had been included in the adult Cochrane review. And the data from them trials had been included in the systematic review. So when you're looking for your randomized controlled trials, sometimes you find these and then you find the data in that overview. What happened is a chap from Japan submitted a comment to the Cochrane review. Anybody who's done a systematic review in Cochrane knows if you've got a comment, you've got 6 months to respond and post a comment. You have the editor team come to you and say, tell me what, please respond within 6 months. And his comment was to say, of the 10 trials that were in the Kaiser review, only two were published as articles in JAMA and Lancet, and the other eight were proceedings of Congress, meetings, data on file, or abstract, and were never published. And then he went in it and said, well, look, you have publication bias because the two reported trials were the only two positive ones, and the other eight were missing lots of data. And that meant 60% of the data was never published whatsoever. And that led us to a whole affair of trying to track down the data. And we used media to try and get to the data. But one of the things is we wrote to the authors of the studies for the original data. And this is what one of the studies said. And this is Deborah Cohen, who was working at the BBPMJ as an investigator. First, he said he did not recall seeing the primary data. The statistical analysis had been conducted by Roche, and he analysed the summary data. Bit concerning? Well, here's the other chap, Frederick Hayden, who then went to the chap who was the corresponding author of the original 10 study review and said, I cannot find the original data to this 2003 publication. You may need to go to Roche. And in the proceedings, this is one of the largest ever trials ever done. If you go into the data, it tells you the number of studied patients. It's about 1,400 patients were in this study. And this is the abstract as presented in 2000 at the International Abstract of the 2000 Annual Infectious Disease Society in America. It's about 300 words, okay? 1,459 patients were enrolled at 164 US study sites. The chap at the top here, John Trenor, said he didn't go to the meeting. He doesn't even remember the abstract or participated in the writing of the abstract and cannot recall the meeting whatsoever. So in 2013, Roche agreed to release all of the trial data on all the Tamiflu drugs. And in doing that, we had a long contractual issue back and forward about how we'd get the data. And you think about information governance and all the issues that come with information governance. And eventually, they just sent me a load of CDs in the post, unsecured. And one day, I got all these CDs, and that was it. 170,000 pages of documents he received. Now, coming back to M76001, remember that study I told you, the 300-word study? So M76001 is a sort of identification. You give a study before it gets published, before it gets into the public domain. And when it's published, it becomes Trenor et al, blah, 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 for M76001. So it's 300-word abstract. The clinical study report for this is, if you can see there at the top, is 9,809 pages. So there's no publication in the middle. So up to this date, we've been using that, and yet there's 9,809 pages available. So the first thing is, you think, well, let's look at the amount of information and what we might get gleaned from this. And up to this point, and probably to about 2010, it was deemed acceptable to use these sorts of abstracts in constructing systematic reviews. Now, I could go into the effects of Tamiflu we found in this systematic review of the clinical study reports. It took us quite a bit of time to evaluate, but what we found is it reduced the duration of symptoms by 16 hours. We already knew that. No effects on rates of hospitalization. Well, that was different because they claimed effects on that. No effects on any bacterial infection in children. And importantly, we managed to say for every 100 people treated, 3 would self-report they don't have pneumonia. Self-report. As opposed to the people in the 5 trials that used an objective diagnosis of pneumonia, there was no effect. So the clinical study reports allowed you to, instead of saying 8 trials, put them together, there was an effect on lower respiratory tract complications. It basically took them apart and said, hold on, the 3 that are positive, it's just people who self-report pneumonia. Well, anybody who knows anything would know that's impossible to do. Do you think you've got pneumonia? Well, the answer is always yes in a clinical setting, because that's what drives your antibiotics. Yeah, and I'd like my antibiotics, please. It's a ridiculous question, but actually, if you used an X-ray, there was no effect. But here's the bit where it gets interesting. Unexpected findings. The 2 publications I showed you, the ones where people had put their name to but didn't actually look at the data or analyze the data or didn't have access to the data, it looks like, stated there were no drug-related serious adverse events. And this has been replicated by NHS organisations and international organisations around the world. There are no serious adverse events were noted in the major trials, and no significant changes were noted in laboratory parameters. That would be reassuring, wouldn't it, if you went to a meeting and said, we're going to use this drug, there are no safety problems. Yeah, immediately we went into the clinical study reports. In the back, this is what's in the 9,000 pages of documents. There are individual table listings. And if you can see that, that's why you had to come up from the back. If you can see that, serious adverse events. Listing of serious adverse events. And there were 10 of them. So how do you go from there were no drug-related serious adventures to there are 10 in just one study report? Again, that's deeply concerning when you think of this is an issue of reporting bias. I'll give you some other examples which it allowed you to do. So at the time, people from these were Public Health England defending the strategy to use Tamiflu to prevent an outbreak. So one of the arguments is in the very elderly, you would have an outbreak of somebody with flu. Somebody would do a test and say, a person's got flu. Therefore, you should use Tamiflu, a Tamiflu prophylaxis. If you give it to everybody else, yeah, you will reduce the known exposure by 8%. Now, what I'm not going to go into the 8% because that I could show you why that. I want you to just think about the generalizability of evidence. This is, we were going to use it in a, known it within a household, a situation to akin that in care homes, all right? So you would expect in research that you would be able to then understand that the research applies to the population you now want to use it. So if you have an idea of somebody in a nursing home, that might generally mean somebody who's elderly, might have comorbidities, lots of other problems. And that generates a question of, do these results apply to my patients? Now, you can then construct, because all of this data is missing from the publication and nobody knows about it, the exclusion criteria. And just think of the type of people you'd see in it. So they can't have cancer, immunosuppression, chronic liver or renal disease. They can't be taking steroids. They can't have unstable or uncontrolled renal, cardiac, pulmonary, vascular, neurological or metabolic disease, diabetes, thyroid, adrenal disorders, hepatitis or cirrhosis. Not only that, if they've got renal disease, they're out. And if they've got cardiac failure, they're also out. Now, if anybody knows a person in a nursing home who is now not excluded, you then now start to go, there's a real problem. So when you looked at the study that Public Health England is using to be akin to a nursing home, there are actually only 17 contact cases over 16 were included in the study. So the whole of our strategy in Public Health England for prophylactic exposure is underpinned by 17 people in a study. However, what it says is, in the short publication, across all ages, it didn't even detail any of the breakdown of the people. So you start to go, when I'm arguing and reasoning with people, is it acceptable to be able to apply a treatment to people who are completely excluded from the study and say that's okay to get on with? Yet we still do that today. Now, the interesting bit, if you go into the Tamiflu promotional material, it's really quite interesting. Just going back, what happened is, this is the misleading efficacy claims that actually, in America, Roche submitted these in America. The pill with the power to stop the flu, tame the flu with Tamiflu. Tamiflu will reduce duration of the flu by 31%. Severity of influenza similar. All misleading, the FDA said. And in fact, what the FDA said, because they'd done a bit more work than in Europe, is Tamiflu has not been shown to prevent such complications. All along, that was actually known. And in fact, in a recent update in 2010, they'd even restated this in America. This is not what it says in America, in Europe and in the UK. It is the complete opposite in terms of, but they may begin with influenza-like symptoms or may coexist with or occur as complication during the course of influenza. Tamiflu has not been shown to prevent such complications. I could go into the 500 million we spent stockpiling this drug at this point. I'm not going to go there. What the message there is to start to think of a significant problem called reporting bias. That the amount of information around a drug is limited when we talk about journal publications and also in many systematic reviews. And I'll come back to this point. But going back, what had also happened at this point, which was really interesting, about 2013-14, all trials had started, and with all trials, Ben Goldacre was part of that, and he came to Oxford, into the Centre for EBM, to set up what's called the EBM Data Lab. And one of the things he was interested in was the publication bias aspect, because he said it's still not gone away, it's still a major problem, despite the fact we've been going on about it now for nearly 30 years. Not much has changed. And we published a few papers that started with looking at some of the issues. So we looked here in Oxford at the Biomedical Research Centre. Oxford receives probably the most research funding in the UK. And in the Biomedical Research Centre, they've done 286 trials we identified. And we set out to try and find, we couldn't find registration for four of these. But of the trials that were registered with a completion date pre-January 2015, just over half were published, and half of these were published within 12 months. Because what had happened is, the European Union was also saying we should be now having to publish our trials within 1 year of completion. Yeah? In 2014, the law changed to say if you finish a trial 12 months, he should publish his results in full. And as you can see in Oxford, now it's supposed to be the bastion of quality, research integrity. We were only doing that about half the time. And some of the information was out of date and inaccurate. And we tried to influence that. Some people were worried about that, but at least we were starting to do audits on our own work. Now, this also then led to what's called the EU trials tracker, because the data lab team are so smart, they can pull the data from the trial registries and the dates and then produce what's called a trials tracker. And that's because the law did change. And from December 2016, all trials on the EU Clinical Trials Register, EUCTR, should post results within 12 months of completion. So in December 2017, it's the law. It's not sort of something you want to do. Remembering it had been the law in America since 2007. It became the law in effect from 2017, because the first date you could see the result was a year later. Okay, now here's the results as a publisher. So this is the traditional journal approach of what it looks like in the journal. So if you, this is a paper in the BMJ, which is a top slice, and this is normally what researchers do and publish a paper with results and says 49.5%, roughly half reported results. Yeah, interestingly though, trials with a commercial sponsor were substantially more likely to post results than those with a non-commercial sponsor. 68 versus 11. Look at the difference. 68 versus 11. Don't tell me. I can't stand the odds ratio. People, you're going to learn about why the odds ratio is misleading, but it's not. It's about six times greater. And those who conducted a large number of trials. But what happened next is, if you go online, you can go on to the EU trials tracker. You can look at it tonight. And you'll see that the numbers got slightly better. So 62%, 61.8%. And you can go online and look at that. Now, I'm doing a form of this talk in Manchester in about a month's time at the Manchester University. And I went in and put Manchester, and they've got three institutions in Manchester. And in wherever I am, if I do this talk, I show them, and they're shocking. They're so bad, they're going to hopefully be embarrassed to death and do something about it in Manchester, because about 25% of their trials are reporting at the moment. In fact, no, what happens is it will accumulate. So once you report, you come within the time frame. So if you report 14 months, you'll be considered to have completed what you should. But what the thing is, you should report by 12 months. And it continues to update. So if a trial, as soon as it reports, it will come out. Yeah? And you can type in, if any of your institutions, you can type in where you are in that institution, university. But it will show, in effect, that academic institutions are pretty dire. Oxford's got better, not least because they know we're auditing it all the time. And also, recently, the HRA has said that actually they're going to start, and the government has said, we're going to start auditing academic institutions to start to look at their performance. And if you don't start to meet this requirement, then I think there's going to be a position where they're going to say, we're going to withdraw your funding. Because the question is it ethically acceptable, if you've still got 40% of your trials unreported, that you should receive more money to do more trials, to publish less results? So it's like, I mean, it doesn't ethically make sense to me. Surely it should be an ethics should go, can we just check online, how are you doing? Because you can look at this by institution, you can look at this by industry sponsorship. And if you aren't reporting in full, surely you should say, we'll wait. Now that is the sort of thing we need in the thinking. So that's where we are. So we can say just a bit more than half of all trials go unreported. And the thing is, can you make informed decisions about treatments if you're a bit wondering 40% of the data may be missing? So we're now in two areas where we've got significant problems, reporting bias and publication bias. Now, the thing is, some things have got better in the time, in a very short period of time. And in 2014, the European Medicines Agency said, what we're going to do is provide online access to clinical data for medicinal products that we approve. And to do this, what they're going to do is make clinical study report data available. So when they approve a drug, the clinical study report will be made available and you will be able to access it. So if you're doing a systematic review of a treatment or intervention, you will be able to get the new drug CSRs now, and you'll also be able to access and ask for some that are before that date. Now, the reason did that is because there are a number of studies that have looked at the type of documentation. So it's okay me giving you one example, but that of Tamiflu, but actually there are more examples of this. And this is in Germany from IQWiG. IQWiG are like the NICE in Germany. The Health Technology Assessment Group in Germany is called IQWiG. And this is B.T. Wiesler, who's head of the Department of their Drug Assessment. He's trying to investigate to what extent different types of documents for reporting clinical trials provide submission information for trial evaluation. So when you get to the HTA aspect of this, you really need the important information in front of you. When NICE looked at Tamiflu, they just looked at journal publications. If you go to this, this is in the BMJ. There's an interesting table in 2015. And for instance, here, they're pointing out here. Does this work? I'll do it the old way. So this row here is study results. And here you've got journal publications. This is posted on the registries, like the EUCTR. And this is the clinical study report, okay? Hard findings, information, and so in the study report, information in there complete on 52% of specific outcomes. In registries, it's 71%. And by the time you get to clinical study reports, it's 91% of specific outcomes in study report. So you can see that there's a shift in information going from journal publications through registries to clinical study reports. These are incredibly useful when they're populated, but I just showed you they're only done about 60% of the time. And these show you the problems here because it'll say, well, they're not publicly available. They're voluminous, so it's pointing out the disadvantages. They're really big to get your head around. But there's been other examples. Here's an example recently about access to clinical study reports in line with the EMA. And it reduced reporting biases for quality of life outcomes. So important information that's missing in the journal. But one of the problems here is pointing out that regulators, unfortunately, only see a fraction of the documentation. And I only learned this recently, that no regulator actually asks for all the evidence. They only ask for the evidence that's sufficient to produce a marketing approval. So the people can submit to them a little bit of the evidence, they can submit different bits to different regulators around the world, and they all get to see different bits. But they do not create a table of all of the studies and say, here's all the studies, and you're looking at only four. So that's a huge problem. But here's another example, and then here's again, in the Orlistat trials, and if people know the study of Orlistat, it was a drug that was used to reduce obesity, but had significant problems with cardiovascular effects. And it's one of the things that it shows is when you look at clinical study reports compared to journal publications, the benefits seem to align. Where the major difference is in understated adverse events, which would make sense, wouldn't it? If you have a journal publication and you want to accentuate positives, you are going to put the positive outcomes in and remove all of the adverse events. And that seemingly is what's happening with the clinical study reports. So last year, one of my other roles is I'm editor-in-chief of BMJ Evidence-Based Medicine. And here's a right good example of what's happening right now. Is a systematic review of HPV vaccine published in the Cochrane Library. Used publications, but then try to use a little bit of registries and a little bit of CSRs without being comprehensive and doing it in a systematic way. And this report caused a lot of controversy because basically in there is a table that they said there's out of there, there's 20 trials that we think they missed, and they definitely missed 16 additional trials which were eligible in the review. And this is a review by a chap in Denmark, Lars Jorgensen, working with Peter Doctor and Tom Jefferson, who was doing his PhD on this whole subject. So it's pretty intense. It's not a few weeks' work. I did a bit of a PubMed search and put my rapid review together. And here they're trying to match the study ID with the funding sponsorship database for the trial ID in the registry, and then trying to match them and say, here's what we think this study is. And so the bit this shows is, it's a bit like you're flying a plane and half the manual's missing, but you don't know which half, and you don't quite know when you'll need that bit of the manual, but it'll probably be when the safety issues happen, and you really want to know when it's just about to hit going downwards, and you're like, what do we do now? And all of that bit is missing. And I think it shows a worrying position that if you wanted to trust the evidence, because many of these decisions are based on small benefits to harm, that you really would want all of the evidence in front of you. And you probably want somebody to look at it in a way that is impartial and puts together the benefits and the harms. To do that takes a long time. This is not a straightforward job. Can't do it for all evidence, but you would expect or think we might do it for the public health drugs, the ones where, like HPV or Tamiflu, where it's likely to be used by a wide spectrum of patients, and it's important to know the benefits and the harms. Now, I'm just going to finish with a few things, which again, this story carries on, and it's a very interesting story, and it's not going away anytime soon. But this is EU trials, and the problem is right now, in 2016, they set out, they had a delay for about a year, which is what EMA does, and it doesn't quite. But as of 1st of August, it suspended all new activities related to clinical data publication. And this is a problem of good old Brexit. Because they've relocated to Amsterdam, they said it's too much work and we have a continuity business plan, and so this is peripheral activity right now. It's not important. And they said by the end of July, but it's not happened yet, will be processed until further notice. We're still on further notice, which is deeply concerning. The flip side though is there anybody in Canada here? Is anybody from Canada here? Well, you guys are leading the field. Are you aware of this? What are you doing in Canada? So in Canada, Health Canada is within 120 days of a decision, Health Canada will post clinical study reports on a new government online portal. And as they say, they set out. But as I understand it, Health Canada is just going to say, here it all is, which is an amazing step forward, because the problem at the moment is even in EMA, you've still got to go to an access system to request them, and then they go through a sort of holding pattern where they go, we're gonna check that there's no data protection issues, we're gonna do some redactions, and about a year later you get the data. So Health Canada have potentially moved the game forward quite considerably, and if they become available, we all could get to work in a way that means you're gonna be very busy sorting out the problems of publication bias and reporting bias. Thank you very much.